accession number 18258, Reel 3.
Reg Dance Reel 3?
Yes.
You were giving me the names?
Yes. Company Sergeant Major Cowley from the Coldstream Guards and Regimental Sergeant Major Brodie from the Irish Guards. Now, these two men had been hand-picked specially by the Commander Glider Pilots, Major Chatterton, later had become full colonel, of course. And he'd picked them, and he wanted them to instill the utmost discipline and esprit de corps, etc., into the glider pilot regiment. And this they certainly succeeded in doing. After the massive drill praise we had, and I must admit that I used to feel very proud marching with the other men of the unit, because we were very, very good at it. As someone said to me later on in the war, you should have been good, you were all volunteers, you'd all passed a high intelligence, etc., test, and therefore you should be good. And that's the way the regiment turned out. So life went on down there with plenty of drill and everything else, and the colonel always used to give us a lecture every night from about 7 o'clock to 8 or 9 about the war and his aims for the regiment. But he became increasingly perturbed by the fact that we couldn't get onto an airfield to start training as pilots. And he obviously mentioned it to General Browning, known as Boy Browning, and he was invited down to explain to General Browning exactly what was going on, which he did, of course. And Browning said, well, we'll have to try and see the man, Churchill. Anyway, that was that. Meanwhile, this training still went on. Now, every Friday in that training was a run march with more or less full equipment. And they got longer and longer as the Fridays went by. And the colonel told us the last 10 men in from the run march will be returned to their unit. They won't be up to the standard I want. And I suppose about 4 or 5 of these Fridays had gone by, and I saw some very good chaps lost to us, people I'd become friendly with. And on this particular Friday, I was running, and I didn't feel all that good when I started out. And I started dropping back and back and back. And as we came up the final mile, which was uphill all the way from the direction of Lark Hill to Tilshead, I looked behind me and all I could see was about 7 or 8 other members of the run. So I dug as deep as I could into my physical reserve and dug in and got past one man, then another, and one more. And I thought, well, I'm all right now. There's 10 or 11 behind me. And when you got back into the camp area, you were in a horrible condition. But the RSM used to come straight out, call you up to attention, and start drilling you. By then, the rest had come up, and we'd be fell in, 10. And we'd be fell in alongside them, but with a gap. And then the colonel would come out, or major as he was then, come out and say, right, well done, you lot. Now, you lot, you know what the penalty was for being in the last 10, and there you are. So, Major, dismiss this 10 to the order room to get travel documents to return to their units. Well, when you're dismissed, your attention, you turn to the right, salute if there's an officer there. And as they went up in the salute, out of the corner of my right eye, because I was right near the edge of this lot, I saw this one fella go down, bang, you know. And the colonel shouted out straight, don't touch him, get the MO. So they went and got the medical officer, who came out, and I was standing so close. And Chatterton said to him, I want to know if that man is unconscious or not. And he rolled his eyes, he said, oh, he's right out, so I'll have to get him in. Right, Sergeant Major, he can stay. And he turned to me and he pointed at me, Chatterton, and I've never forgotten it, because it's very important. He said to me, This is what it's all about. You are not finished until you're either unconscious or dead. If you're conscious, you can still do a bit more, which was roughly what I had to do, you know. And that always stuck with me, that. But that system went on for about another 2 weeks, and then the War Office stopped it because the turnover was too great. But the colonel had got what he wanted, and the nucleus of the regiment as it was then, which must have been up to about 120, 140, had all passed this sort of test. And then one day he disappeared, he came back, and he fell us all in on the parade ground, and he said, right, I've got good news. I've just come back from a meeting with the man himself, Winston Churchill. I, together with Boy Browning, General Browning, went in to see him. He said, Churchill was sitting there, never even looked up. He said, we both stood there and saluted. And he said, Churchill went on writing and signing. And then he said, right, you've got a minute to tell me your problem. And Browning spoke up straight away. And then he looked up and he asked Chatterton, are you the man in charge of this jet? So you want to start flying now, do you, to get the red right? Go back to your units, tell them to stand to for trucks. And within the hours, trucks arrived, and I was taken to RAF Booker, just west of London, at High Wycombe Way, you know. Others went to Derby, some went to Derby, some all over the place, all to training RAF units that were giving elementary flying training. And when I got there to Booker, it was an airfield, and I thought, right, this is it, now we start proper, you know. But then suddenly I was told, my name and several others, well, you won't do your flying training here, you'll do your flying training at Denham. Now, Denham was even closer to London, right next door to the Denham Film Studios. It was a private airfield before the war, and it only had a little bungalow there, which was the headquarters, and some old tin hangars with these Tiger Moth aircraft. And that's where we went by RAF coach every morning from Booker down to Denham, and then he would bring us back when we'd finished our flying training. And that's where we did our flying training. And, well, I did pretty well there. I got an above average pass out, you know, once I knew what I was doing. But the thing I always remember there was that once you could fly, you used to lark about quite a bit once you were in the air. And we used to go up as high as we could and dive through these cumulus clouds to try and take the top off, you know. But also we did a bit of low flying, which we shouldn't do. And I can remember two or three of us flew low over the Denham Film Studios, and there was this huge tank, like a storage tank, but much bigger. And we could see this wooden structure going up and down, and chaps throwing water up in the air. And it never crossed my mind what they were doing, but we landed. And the next day, we were all called together when we got down there for flying. And the flight commander there, Mackay, that's right, flying off to Mackay, he called us in and said, there's someone here who wants to speak to you. And it was a film producer from Denham. And he said, well, we're full of admiration for you chaps. We know what you're doing, all the rest of it. I don't think they knew we were going to be glider pilots, but pilots. He said, but we're making a film down there at the moment. It's going to be called In Which We Serve. And yesterday we had a lovely take of about 12 minutes. And Noel Coward was on the bridge, and the rig was moving, and the waves were going, and people were throwing buckets of water over him. And then suddenly a tiger moth flew across the shot. Now, we've had to scrap that lot. Could you please keep clear of the studio? So we said, all right. And he said, well, if you'll meet in this pub, I think it was called down in Denham tonight, we'll see you get a drink or two. But that's what stood out there. Anyway, I passed out. And then I went back down to Tilshead until we were told, right, you're going on now to heavy glider conversion. Sorry, Hotspur light glider training, and we went up to Leinster near the Welsh border, and we flew these. I thought they were horrible little things. They looked all right. They carried six men, two pilots, in tandem in the front, and six people behind. And, you know, the average man would be like that, facing forwards. It was a tiny thing.
Like a fetus.
Yeah, that's right. And anyway, we learned to fly these gliders in that. And they weren't bad, but they had a habit, a very nasty habit. We had to do dive approaches, you know, used to pull off at about 2,000 feet. And once you were clear of the tow rope and everything, just dive straight down. I mean straight down till you've got absolute maximum speed. And then level out at ground level and hedge hop across fields until you could land, you know. But what used to happen after a while, never happened to me, so I wouldn't be talking now. Chaps would do that and pull out, and as they pulled out, the strain on the tow unit was so great, it came off, and they just went straight into the ground. Now, normally there was only the two pilots who were killed, but later on, when they had a live load on board of six infantrymen, they were killed. So they had to revise that. But once we got through there, we then went straight down to Bryce Norton, still there, of course, for the heavy glider conversion unit. And again, the thing I remember about that was getting out of the lorry and being alongside some office building, you know, and then some hangars. And while we were waiting to find out what was happening, I just wandered off and I got up to this very large hangar and I went beyond the doors and I looked round the corner. And there was this massive, great tail unit. Now, the Hotspur tail unit was about 2'6" high, that's all. But this thing went up about 25 feet. Massive. And there was this huge wooden glider, the size of a Halifax bomber, you see. And I thought, God, it's going to be a change. Anyway, they were a delight to fly, those aircraft. They really were. I always said to the chap, I would pay to fly, you know, as long as they give me my food and bedding. It was lovely flying those.
And what were they called?
Horsa, H-O-R-S-A. All the gliders began with H. There was the Henquist, the Horsa, the Hamilcar, which is the tank-carrying one. And we, as I say, became proficient at that. And then we were shoved down to Hearn Airport and based... billeted down at Christchurch on the edge of Bournemouth, which was a very pleasant part of our time. And after that, we used to do a bit of commando training down there. We used to use the Royal Marines battle course, which included crossing the River Avon with all your gear and no bridge or boat, you know. Starting to lose my voice a bit. But we got through all that all right, you know, and that side of it was pretty tough, but the life on the edge of Bournemouth was quite pleasant. But from there, we suddenly got a call up, and the next thing we were entrained and up to Greenock in Scotland. And we got on this filthy old boat. It was a Dutch East Indies banana boat. Now, it had a certain amount of quarters on it, but for the majority of us, it was just down in the hold. And the only way out of that hold in an emergency was for anyone on deck to take the hatch covers off and drop netting down or rope ladders. The only way out. And I thought at the time, my God, you know, the best part of the regiment will go down if we get hit, you know. Anyway, off we went, and this thing rolled, and it was a terrible journey out there. But eventually we got to the Mediterranean, and we knew then that we were destined for the Middle East, you know. And we landed at Oran, which, of course, was a big French naval base. And when we landed there, it was dark. You could still see these battleships, especially the Admiral Richelieu, which was the pride of the French Navy, was a superstructure, was just out of the water. But below ground and in this lovely clear Mediterranean, you could still see these fires burning as phosphorus bombs and that were going off, you know. And it was quite a sight. And of course, when we got ashore, the French population were very anti-British, and they were emptying liquid on us from the top windows, and we all knew what it was, you know. But eventually we got out of Oran at a road junction, and we met some American trucks and drivers. Most of the drivers were American coloured chaps, you know, with a big fat cigar in their mouth. And we got on board these things, and out we went, and the next thing, we were climbing up these roads up into the Atlas Mountains, over the top, and then down the other side. And you could see this great flat area ahead of you, and of course, that's on the way down towards Sahara. And we got down there to a place called Tizi, I think it was, T-I-Z-I. And under tents again, pup tents, as the Americans called them. Well, they were right for someone who was 5 foot tall, but anyone above that, either your head or your feet were out the tent, you know. And we stayed there and we did route marches in the sand and all the rest of it. Then again, we weren't near any flying, you see. But then again, we were told, right, you're going to a place called Relizon, which is a French Air Force base, quite near the edge of the Sahara. And that's where we went. And we, at least our accommodation then there was reasonable, because it was sort of brick huts, all tiled inside, tiled floor. So it was nice and cool, you know. And then eventually some wacko American gliders arrived. And we had to start converting onto those. They were a completely different setup to ours. The hawser had huge flaps, which you use to make these steep dives and to cut down speed. But the wacko only had spoilers, which are things which come out of the upper part of the wing and stick up like that to make a turbulence so that you sink. But they didn't sink as quick as the hawser did, you know. So I wasn't all that happy with them, but we did enough training in them to get to handle them. And then one day, of course, the order came through that we were to load up with troops. And troops arrived out of nowhere, and they were the South Staffordshire Regiment infantry, who were going to be glider-borne troops, you know. And we had to load them up, and then we were faced with this 7-hour trip through the Atlas Mountains, right across to the area of Sousse in Libya. And that was a hair-raising trip, that was, because you get a lot of turbulence in the air where you're above granite or anything like that which holds the heat and doesn't disperse it quickly but sends it up, you know. And, you know, the glider was going all over the place. The chaps in the back were being violently sick. And but once we came through and came down, it got a bit better, of course, but it was a long, long trip. And at that time, I didn't smoke. I don't smoke now, I know, but when we landed, I had a job to get my arms back into their correct position. I'd been hanging onto that wheel all the time and fighting this turbulence that all my back muscles seemed to be cramped up, you know. Anyway, we got down safe on this strip, and I told the chaps to get out and get under the wings for a bit of shade, and I joined them, and I think my arms must have been shaking, because the sergeant of the South Staffs came up and said, hang on, mate, have a cigarette. He said, your arms are shaking. I said, yeah, it's all round my back. And I had this puff or two and a cigarette, which nearly turned me around, you know, and put me off them anyway. But then we got settled into units, etc., and a couple of landing strips, which were simply the sand rolled flat, and they used to pour old used oil on it to try and bind it together, but it still blew up, so that when you took off behind a Dakota, which was the tug aircraft out there, the Dakota's engines would blow all the sand up, and you'd see the Dakota take off, but then as soon as the rope tightened and you started to roll, he would open his throttles full and he would disappear then in a sandstorm. And all you could look at was a first couple of yards of the rope, and you went by that whether you knew you were behind him, below or above, you know. And of course on takeoff you tried to keep level with him, otherwise you're lifting his tail up and he can't get off. Yeah, but we soon settled down to the flying conditions and became reasonably proficient. But we hadn't done any night flying. And then suddenly Colonel Chapton arrived and said, you've got to do some night flying and do it quickly. There must be some tonight. And night flying was organised very quickly. And on this strip, of course, you had no electric power anywhere, so you hadn't got any lights. So we'd some biscuit tins, large biscuit tins, were got hold of from the cookhouse or somewhere. These were half filled with sand, and then a mixture of petrol and oil was poured in, and these were ignited, and they worked pretty roughly as a light. And these were put at intervals of, say, 50 yards along a strip in a straight line for landing on in the dark. So night flying commenced. And I did my two or three trips around, and then I came down. Now, the control from the ground was simply an Aldis lamp, and another glider pilot on the ground would watch you go round in the night sky against that blue night sky of the Mediterranean, and he could see the tiny lights on the Dakota tug aircraft anyway. There were no lights, of course, on the glider. And as you came round downwind, making the final crosswind approach, he would shine a green at the tug aircraft, who would respond by just flashing his down signal, and then a green at the cockpit of the glider, 100 yards behind, saying, OK, it's OK to come in and land. So the tug was ready for the glider to drop away, and the glider was ready to come in and land. And this was a simple thing, and it worked. Well, after I'd done my stint of these night trips, Chatterton was there on the ground. He said to me, right, O'Dance, take over the oldest lamp, which I did. And two or three items went round, and then Chatterton was still standing there because he was interested in that we all became reasonably proficient at night flying there. And another unit came round, a tug and a glider, and I watched him, and I gave the tug a green, and he didn't seem to respond. But I knew the glider would want to come in and land. So I kept following, and Chatham called out to me, leave him, get the glider down. So I gave him the green, and by then it was a bit late for him, but he pulled off and he came in and made to land him. But I continued to watch the tug aircraft. And he went round on the usual circuit in the sky, but then instead of coming in across wind down there and then round again to come in and land, he continued flying. And I kept a green light on him all the time and flashing it, and chattered and said, I don't know what the hell he's up to, you know. And I said, but the Atlas Mountains are dead in front of him, sir. And the next minute, boom, just a great flash, and he'd gone straight into the mountains. That was an American tug with his crew. And what they were doing, I don't know, you know. But one of those things. And, of course, from then on, the side of the mountain, the engines fell out of the doomed aircraft and rolled down in flames. Of course, they ignited all the brush and bushes and all that all the way down the mountainside. And I remember chatting, saying, right, get the next lot off. And this American captain came over and said something like, oh, hell, you can't do that. That's our buddies up there. And Chatterton simply said to him, well, what can you do for your buddies up there? They shouldn't have been up there. They flew into the mountain themselves. And there's a war on. It's got to go on. You've got to keep flying. And he had to use all his rank and everything to force that American to get his lads to take off again. But there we are. Anyway, then, of course, things settled down. Suddenly we got the orders that we were to do an invasion of Sicily, airborne invasion of Sicily, at just a few hours before a sea landing was made. We had very short notice of this, but eventually men of the South Staffs arrived on the strip, and the day was fast approaching, and I always remember we were queuing up to get some tea. That's all you wanted out there was tea. And we were in a long queue with our half messed in getting some tea. And suddenly there was the most God almighty explosion coming from just outside the camp. And it was the ammunition dump blowing up, our own ammunition dump for the airborne forces. And no one was killed, but the air was full of shells and items thrown out by the explosion, which were sizzling on the ground, you know. Chatterton was in his tent at the time, and he came rushing out with his Tommy gun, shouting out, "Where are they? Where are they?" He thought we'd been invaded, I think. But that wasn't a very good start to the invasion, really. And eventually we got new stuff came down, and we went over to the strips, loaded up the South Staffordshire Regiment on the gliders, and took off. The idea was to fly due north over the Mediterranean and fly just to the east of Malta, which we should see in the sea down there. By the way, it was supposed to be a moonlit night with calm conditions. In fact, it was a stormy night with gale force winds and no moon. But you could still see Malta down there. And then from there you just veered a bit northwest to hit this corner of Sicily. And we flew on. You could just about make out another glider unit up front, you know. You couldn't see backwards, of course. You could have been on your own as far as it goes. And we hit the tail end of Sicily, Ponto something it was called. And straight away, ACAC fire came up, which the first time you see it is very fascinating. It seems to come up wandering like that, very slowly, and then, whoom, it's past you. And you get a hell of a bang, of course. But it seems so leisurely coming up, like a firework almost, you know. Anyway, we expected anti-aircraft fire, but the Yankee tug pilots didn't. I don't know why, but they didn't. So they veered off to sea. And instead of running up 100 or 200 yards out to sea from the coastline, they ran up about 2 miles outside. Now, the wind was offshore, and I'm shouting down the intercom, "You've got to get me in closer, I can't make it, I can't make it." And I didn't get any replies, and then suddenly a tremendous bang hit my cockpit, Perspex cockpit, and smashed the top of it. Now, that was the thing called the Lobel lug, which was a big metal thing which went into the jaws of a clamp on the back of the tug aircraft, and there was two under the wings of my aircraft. Well, he'd cast me off, so I said a few words which weren't complimentary and turned to my left to try and make the shore, which I could see, but it was miles away. So I called out dinghy, 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 dinghy to let the blokes in the black know. That was the word to let them know we're going in the sea, and they had to inflate their little rubber tyres and stuff like that. And the next minute I made a pretty good landing on the sea. My second pilot, I'd told him to go in the back with the others and lay flat on the floor, which he did, and they got out of the actual door of the glider, and I could hear them up on the wingtip.